This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today on the program, we are airing a candidate conversation with the major party nominees running to represent Utah's 4th U.S. Congressional District. Democratic incumbent Representative Ben McAdams and Republican challenger Burgess Owens. This week's conversation is part of Informed Decisions 2020, a collaboration between the Hinckley Institute of Politics and the Kempsey Gardner Policy Institute. This series is meant to educate Utah voters and familiarize them with candidates in key races throughout the state. Jason Perry, director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics, moderates today's conversation between Democrat Representative Ben McAdams and Republican nominee Burgess Owens. They discuss issues facing the state and how they would contribute to Congress on the national level. This forum was recorded on October 14, 2020. Here is your moderator, Director Jason Perry.
Welcome, everyone, to Informed Decisions 2020. I'm Jason Perry, the director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics. Every election cycle, we team up with the Gardner Policy Institute to talk about the issues that are top of mind for Utahns. A policy brief is issued on those key issues, taking no sides, but talking about the policies themselves. And we'll spend a lot of our time with these candidates today talking about those particular policies. We had a coin toss before this Zoom experience started, and it was decided that Congressman Ben McAdams would go first in this conversation. Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics for this Informed Decisions 2020, Congressman.
Thank you, Jason. Great to be with you.
Well, let's just jump right in. I want to take just a moment about you. Of course, you've been in the public eye for some time. Of course, a former Hinckley intern yourself, which we appreciate. But maybe as we get going forward, something we don't know about you, an interesting thing about you that the voters probably should or would like to know.
Well, okay, so here's something. When I was a Hinckley intern and a struggling college student trying to make ends meet, I oftentimes worked two or three jobs to put myself through college. And then I did my Hinckley internship that paid even worse than minimum wage. So it's with some sacrifice and commitment that you do these internships. But one of the things I did to make ends meet was I started donating plasma or selling plasma. I think they paid like $20 each time you went in. And it was great for me as a college student because I could sell my plasma, get $20, and I could actually get some reading done for class while I was donating plasma. And now I feel like my life has come full circle because now I'm a member of Congress and I once again find myself donating plasma, not selling it, but giving it away for free because I had COVID. And so the doctors want my blood antibodies so they can use them. I think it's through AARP and a study they're doing and to try and help people who have COVID-19 to get better.
Wow, it has come full circle, that's for sure. One moment, if we can take on and why you decided. You started running for office first before when you were the Salt Lake County Mayor. What made you decide to run for office there and then? Because this is a difficult decision. Just give us an idea how you and your family decided this is something you wanted to do.
Well, before I ever ran for office, I'm an attorney and I was practicing law. I did securities law, which is stocks and IPOs and working with businesses. And I actually taught securities regulation at the S.J. Quinney College of Law. And I had an opportunity to run for office, and it was a substantial deviation from my private sector career at the time. My wife always says that I've never been offered a pay cut that I didn't take, but for me, it was an opportunity to give back. I think we are lucky as Utahns to live in a pretty incredible community that the people, everybody who comes here to visit talks about how amazing the people are, but I think our people are even better than our second best quality, which is the natural landscape that surrounds us, the beauty and the opportunities to recreate. This is really a pretty special place. And I really believe that where much is given, much is expected. And I found myself in a place that I could give back to our community to fight to keep what we love about this special place in which we live.
Mm-hmm. I want to get into a couple of policy areas, but first want to get an idea about your general approach. What's interesting about the 4th Congressional District is it's highly competitive, but also you have a very well-informed set of constituents, more than you see in many places, particularly in the country. They're just very well connected to the process. When you are approached about a bill or about a policy right now in your position, just take a second about how you approach that. How do you decide what the right policy or approach is given a varied set of interests in your district?
Well, first of all, I think good policy starts with listening. And I am somebody who's always had an open door. I take the time to meet with my constituents. I host public meetings and town hall meetings. And I want to know how a particular policy that's being considered, whether it's here in the state of Utah or a policy that's being debated in Washington, I want to know how it's going to affect people on the ground in Utah. And as I hear stories of people, it really helps me to know what they want me fighting for. My job title, I'm Representative Ben McAdams, but I also think that's my job description. It's to represent people here in Utah. And, you know, when I'm doing that, I hear stories like from a constituent of mine, Camille, who has a son with a pre-existing condition. And Camille tells me about how hard it is for their family to afford the expensive medication that they have to pay for every month. And as they're struggling to make ends meet, and both Camille and her husband work very hard and most of their discretionary income, probably more than their discretionary income, goes toward paying for medication to keep their son alive. And all the while they're fighting insurance companies and fighting murky areas in the law to keep access to their healthcare. And as I hear their story and how hard it is for them to be able to provide for their family and also provide for the health of their son with this illness, I know that it's important that as a member of Congress, I do everything I can to make sure that people have access to quality healthcare, that no one is ever denied healthcare because of a pre-existing condition, that people are able to afford healthcare, that the cost of prescription drugs have gone up so much in recent years. We've got to have solutions to bring down the price of prescription drugs. And if we want policies that are going to help people here in Utah, like Camille, like Mindy is another constituent of mine who has a 20-year-old son with diabetes and they struggle to afford his insulin, I know that we've got to do it in a bipartisan way. We've got to work, Republicans and Democrats have to work with the president to get legislation that's going to impact people's lives. And so that's how I approach problem solving, is to listen to hear what's important from my constituents. And then I work to find solutions, not talking points that you can take on cable news, but solutions that can get an agreement from Republicans and Democrats, House and the Senate, and ultimately signed by the president, because the cost of failure means a real impact on people like Mindy and like Camille.
How has that changed given the realities of COVID-19? There were days when you just come face to face with those people, you'd have the town hall meetings. Can't do that so much now. What's the most effective way for you in your district?
Yeah, well, we still try to reach out to my constituents. We've been doing actually a lot of Zoom meetings, and we found that they are effective. I think nothing replaces the in-person stuff, and I miss that and look forward to getting back to where we can shake hands and engage one-on-one and look people in the eye and hear their concerns. But we're not in a place we can do that right now. And so I try to set a good example and do what's right by following the guidelines of Governor Herbert and our public health officials to also limit public gatherings that we host. So we do a lot by Zoom, a lot of conference calls and teletown halls. And we found that's an effective way to continue to hear from people, to let them know what I'm doing as their representative, so they're informed about the hard work that I'm doing, and then to solicit input from them about what's important and what they want me to do. And, you know, it's in some of those calls that we've held over the last few months during COVID that I've heard from, like, small businesses who just are struggling to keep their doors open with the economic slowdown that's happened because of COVID. You know, a lot of families are really struggling. They're feeling a lot of hardship. And a lot of businesses that they may be open today, but the traffic through their doors just isn't what it was just earlier this year, and they're struggling. And so we've been able to push forward things like the PPP, the Payroll Protection Program, to help those small businesses continue to make ends meet and to put money in the pocket of their employees. We heard from small businesses that the PPP was complicated And so we went back and we were able to simplify that. And again, a bipartisan agreement that got the signature of the president to streamline that program a little bit, to again, help to get resources to those who needed it. I also, in one of those calls, heard about the money was running out and small businesses who had applied for it didn't get the funding. And then I was reading in the news that large businesses like Shake Shack or Ruth's Chris Steakhouse or even the LA Lakers had gotten millions of dollars of these loans that were intended for small businesses. And so I fought for disclosure of how those dollars were spent. And it was pulling teeth at first to, you know, we were pushing on Treasury and pushing on the SBA to disclose who the recipients were of those loans, because I think the taxpayers deserve to know where their dollars are being spent. And we ultimately got most of what I wanted. They disclosed those who received loans of over $2 million. I wanted to see every, and I still want to see everyone disclosed, but we got disclosure of those who received over $2 million. And what we saw happen is some of those businesses decided to give the money back. They felt ashamed that they had taken money that was intended for smaller businesses. They gave it back, and we were able to get that money reprioritized to the small businesses who really needed it. So, you know, we've had a lot of good feedback from my constituents, and I really feel that listening and being accessible helps me do my job of being their representative.
Mm-hmm. I want to pick up on a couple of those key points that you mentioned in terms of the policies, but by way of an introduction to those things too, as the Hinckley Institute has done some polling in your district about the issues that the voters there are most interested in. The question was about the factors going into their vote for people who are leading the United States, talk about the president in particular. But as we talk about those particular items, they have a nice reflection on what is most important in your district. 40% of the people in the 4th Congressional District said the economy was their number one issue, followed by COVID-19 was at 19%, healthcare. All these were in the comments that you just said. So I want to go through those for just a moment, a little more about the threads that you had talked about. Let's talk about COVID-19 and the economy, because they are connected. You just mentioned a couple items. There's been some discussion about whether or not there should be another a package, some kind of stimulus package from the federal government. What do you think about that one way or the other, and why?
Well, I think you're right, Jason, that, I mean, first of all, they are very much related. I had COVID-19, as everybody knows, and I spent 8 days in the hospital struggling to breathe. I know how serious this virus is and how important it is that we come together. We can get through this, but it's going to happen because we come together as a community. The virus doesn't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat. The virus, you know, we know that certain people are maybe more at risk, but I'm 45 years old. I'm relatively healthy, and I don't have any underlying health conditions. And as I said, I spent 8 days in the hospital struggling to breathe. So this virus is hitting all of us hard. And even if you haven't come down with the virus, we all are feeling the economic weight of it. So I think there's work that needs to be done. Early on, Congress came together, as I mentioned, with the CARES Act. That included the PPP, the Payroll Protection Program that I talked about, came forward with a plan that we put the health and well-being of the American people, or lives and livelihood of the American people, first. And we got legislation done that threw a life preserver to people who really needed it. Unfortunately, Washington then fell into partisanship and disagreement between the House and the Senate, between Republicans and Democrats. And I think they failed to come forward with additional proposals that can get the help to the American people. And I think that's wrong. I've been somebody who all along has called for Republicans and Democrats to put partisanship aside, to come to an agreement, to recognize that there's nobody's going to get 100% of what they want. The American people should come first, not partisan interests, and we need to get a deal done. And one of the first things I did when I was elected was I joined a group of a group called the Problem Solvers Caucus. Problem Solvers Caucus. In order to join, you have to join together with somebody from the other party. So they're the Problem Solvers. We are 25 Republicans, 25 Democrats, and we meet together on a regular basis to talk about issues and issues where there's gridlock and how we can break the gridlock. The Problem Solvers, about a month and a half ago, came forward with a proposal of a COVID package that received strong support from Republicans and Democrats. We all hoped that this would break the logjam and restart talks, and talks did restart. Unfortunately, we've seen those talks have been on again, off again. And we're at the point right now that Pelosi and Trump don't even speak, and talks are stymied again. And I think both parties have let down the American people. I hope that we can get a deal done, and we can do something on two fronts: to a plan to slow the spread of this virus, to protect the healthcare and the health of the American people who are really struggling right now, and then something that can shore up the economy to keep the foundations of our economy strong and to help those businesses and families that are really struggling. We need a deal. Now, I would also say, and I need to say that the Democrats in the House passed a package early in the summer. I voted against that. While I do want to see a deal, and I'm encouraging everybody to stay at the table to get a deal done, I do worry that the Democratic package that came forward was laden down with partisan wish list items, things that had nothing to do with COVID. And so I've been calling on my own party to strip out some of those things that are unrelated to COVID, those partisan wish list items that were in the bill, strip those out, and come to the table with a package that can get that's specifically and narrowly tailored to the pandemic itself, and to get something done. So while I am strongly supportive of another package to get that life preserver to the people who need it, this is not a time to do to throw in a whole bunch of unrelated items. Anything we spend today is going to have to be paid for sooner or later. And so, you know, to me, what also weighs on my mind is addressing the crisis that we're in the present, but not forgetting the long-term priority of fiscal responsibility, and that we have to act in a way that is fiscally responsible.
Are those a couple of things? I'm just kind of curious what you think would get your support in that too, because it does happen all the time in Washington, D.C. People are putting ornaments on the tree that don't necessarily belong there. What are a couple of those just key principles? You talked about those long-term economic principles also, but what would the ideal package be and contain for you?
Well, I mean, I hate deficit spending. I think the first bill I introduced when I was elected was a legislation to amend the Constitution to require a balanced budget. Fiscal priority is an enormous priority of mine, but I think we have to acknowledge that in the middle of this crisis, standing on the sidelines and watching the economy go off a cliff and crash and burn would be terrible for the deficit. So we do have to respond to this crisis. Just like if my home got a leak, I'd have to fix the roof because the damage would be worse if I didn't do anything. So I recognize that right now we're in a crisis. We have to take steps to move forward. So I do support moving forward, knowing that that it's going to cost some money. But I think we need to be conscious and spend what's necessary, not, as you said, those Christmas tree items, but some things that get my support. I think we need another round of PPP, the Payroll Protection Program for small businesses. I hear from businesses on a daily basis that are really struggling right now. And I think that PPP can be narrowly tailored. I would want to make sure that we close any loopholes, so it's not going to well-connected large businesses like those who got it last time around. I would want to bake into the proposal transparency and accountability so that we're not having to pound on Treasury and the SBA to get disclosure. But let's write that into the law up front. We had it in the CARES Act, the first round of legislation, but we had an inspector general who was appointed, called for an inspector general. That inspector general was never appointed. So the accountability measure the first time around didn't work. So I would insist on a new round of legislation having greater transparency and accountability for the use of tax dollars. I think we need another round of economic impact payments to families and individuals that are struggling. That should also be narrowly tailored. I don't need it. There are a lot of people who are actually doing fine right now. Some people that I talk to are even doing better financially in the midst of this pandemic. Let's tailor it narrowly so that it goes to people who really need it. And then I think what I still want to see is, what is the plan to slow the spread of this virus? We're seeing in Utah an uptick. And I think this is where Washington has really failed, is to not come forward on a coherent plan that's agreed by Republicans and Democrats to protect people who are vulnerable, to slow the spread of this virus, and to because the economy is never going to recover until we get this virus under control.
Mm-hmm. A question connected to that as well that people have asked me about a lot, and everyone's talking about this vaccine, when it comes, who's going to get it, who's willing to take it. But I'm curious what you see the role of Congress is in that particular question. How can you help it along, maybe getting out of the way or maybe even infusing in some way? What is the right approach?
Well, I think a few things that we've done well, and that is to support the scientific research and to do that. One of the things that that the Trump administration did well was pre-funding the manufacture of the vaccine. So, because normally in the development of a vaccine, you would have the scientific research, then you do the trial. And once it's gone through all the trial and proof, then you start manufacturing. And you may be 6 months manufacturing the vaccine before you can have wide-scale deployment. Because no pharmaceutical company wants to spend all the money to manufacture 100 million doses if it's not going to work. So where the government stepped in here to say there is a societal interest and an economic interest in shortening the window from when a vaccine is developed to when it is wide-scale deployment. And so we said, look, we'll pay for it. And if the vaccine doesn't work, then the company's not on the hook. I think that helped to shorten the time frame for bringing that vaccine to market. That was something we did well. What we need to do is to make sure that we allow the scientists to do their job, step out of the way, not make this partisan or political. Let's let science and public health professionals guide the development of this vaccine, develop a plan for deploying the vaccine. I think those who are medically frail and vulnerable probably need it first, along with our frontline healthcare workers, our doctors and our nurses. And then other frontline workers in other industries are probably the people who need to be front in line to get it. And then I think what we need to do is do everything we can to instill trust in the American people that a vaccine is safe and effective. And I think we can best do that by not making it partisan. Now, when I started about this special place we live in here in Utah, and I do want to give a shout out to our governor. I think in retrospect, we can all say if we had done this better, different or that different, we'd be better off. But the one thing our governor has consistently done well is not made this a political partisan issue. Our governor has focused on, I think, doing what's right for the people of Utah. And it hasn't been about Republicans and Democrats. It's been about slowing the spread of the virus. And I said, people have different opinions about whether we made the right call at every turn. But I don't think anybody disputes that his motives and intentions were good. And I think we need to see the same from Washington that we've seen here in Utah.
I want to turn for a moment to your district itself, with the special needs it might have, the policies that you're under consideration. And CD4 is one of those interesting districts in our state. It has some the most densely populated areas, from Mill Creek, Salt Lake, the suburbs, Salt Lake, and even into some of the rural areas, particularly into San Pete County. You have a wide range of area and interests that you are responsible for. How do you go about making sure that you are keeping both of those balanced, those interests?
Well, for me, it starts with, again, listening. My job title is representative. That is also my job description, to represent the people in my district. And you can't represent people that you don't know and you're not accessible to. So for me, all along, I've prioritized, as I said, the public meetings and town hall meetings and one-on-one meetings with my constituents and really having an open door. And I spend a lot of time when I'm home in Utah. My family still lives here in Utah, so I'm home every weekend and always in my office and then traveling throughout the district to meet with individuals, to meet with businesses, to meet with elected officials throughout the district and to hear their concerns. And our district is diverse, politically diverse, from some very conservative areas to more progressive areas to urban and rural. And people have different expectations of what they want from a member of Congress. I've usually found, though, that by listening and working to bring people together, we can find common ground and we can find things that are a win-win for everyone. I'll give you an example again with COVID. I fought for expansion of telehealth. Now, telehealth is good for our rural areas that don't have always the quickest access to medical professionals. Telehealth has also been good now in urban areas because people are able to have medical consults without having to leave their home if they're worried, if they're medically frail or otherwise. And so we found that deployment of broadband. I have four kids in school here in Utah, and we are entirely online learning right now. And we're fortunate to have good broadband access where we live. But this virus has laid bare for us some of the discrepancies, whether it's rural areas or low-income areas here in Utah, where people just don't have the same access to education and learning or medicine. And what I've really found is that there is actually, as you listen and to people and their concerns and take a deep dive into the challenges we face, you can usually find some common ground and common solutions.
What do you think the number one issue is in your district that you are trying to address?
Most certainly right now, I would say healthcare and the economy. And they are related. Our economy is not going to fully recover until we have the virus under control. And people are really struggling right now. People are hurting. And there's a lot of financial hardship and fears for people's health. And certainly that's I think, the thing I hear about the most.
I want to get to a couple of things happening in Washington, D.C. A question from someone watching right now, Congressman. What do you hope to accomplish if you get the opportunity to be elected as a representative again?
Yeah, well, let me tell you a few things that I've been working on. First, some issues that are really specific to Utah, which is air quality, and working to identify solutions and things we can implement to improve our air here in Utah. I have a priority of mine has been protecting our kids, both online and from trafficking. So I, in 2018, passed legislation to help to address online child pornography and just passed through the House earlier this summer, the Stifle Act. So I'm on the Financial Services Committee, and I've worked with my Republican colleague on financial services, also a member of the Problem Solvers group that I talked about, Representative Anthony Gonzalez. We passed the Stifle Act. The Stifle Act looks to follow global financial transactions and identify patterns that would help us find traffickers so we can get to the source and the money underlying child trafficking and stop it. And then I'm working to, as a parent of four kids and my kids now with COVID spend so much more time online, as much as we wish they didn't. And we try to put other activities in front of them, but with online school and everything, our kids are online a lot more. And I worry about the predators and the dangerous content that's online. And I don't think our technology companies are doing enough to protect our kids from that content. As a parent, I'm always trying to figure out my way through a new app and to put safety protocols on the app for our kids. And it's, new apps are out before I figured out how to run the old one. And I think we need to expect our technology partners to be true partners in helping to protect our kids online. So those are some issues that are really important to me. I plan to continue to make my push for fiscal responsibility, to rein in spending and get our fiscal house in order in DC. We see this crisis, I think, highlights to us what a precarious situation we're in financially. And we're doing what we have to do, but how much better off we'd be if we had a rainy day fund rather than deficit spending as far as the eye can see to get through a crisis. So I would say those are some of the things that are priorities of mine. The other one I plan to work on is stopping a congressional pay raise. Last year, there was a proposal. I found out that Democratic leadership and Republican leadership had agreed to a plan to give Congress a pay raise. Now, mind you, this was 2 months after we had just had the longest government shutdown in American history, and we've been years without passing a budget. And so I was pretty offended at that notion, to think that that Congress was going to prioritize giving themselves a pay increase when they haven't done the basic functions of their job. So I led the charge to stop that congressional pay increase, and I'll continue to fight that in the future, because I don't think that until Congress can do, I think everybody at home knows that if you're not doing your job, your boss isn't going to give you a raise. And our boss is the American people. And if we're having government shutdowns and failing to pass a budget and failing to address some of the crises that people are really struggling with back home, a pay increase should be the last thing on the table.
Maybe we can end, Congressman, with just one small point from this statement from Mitt Romney yesterday. It goes to what your last comment was in this as well. It was an interesting conversation that he's having with the press right now, and he issued a statement where he talked about Washington, D.C., and his words were quite strong. He says, what's happening in D.C. is a vile, vituperative, and hate-filled morass that is unbecoming of any free nation, really talking about the fighting. What do you think about that statement right there, and what are you doing to help with the civility in politics?
Well, I love that Mitt Romney said that, and I am grateful for the leadership he's providing in Congress to try to call out the failings of Washington where he sees them. And it's been an honor of mine to work with him. We don't always agree on every issue, but I know that he is a person of integrity and ethics and approaches his job with seriousness. And I value his public service. I am Utah's most independent member of Congress and pride myself in also being somebody who reaches across the aisle, who tries to build coalitions. I am the number two in the entire Congress as someone who votes against my own party. And I think we need people who are willing to put people first, to put parties last, and to work to find solutions, and to recognize that there are good ideas on both sides of the aisle. There are bad ideas and bad people on both sides of the aisle, but there are good ideas and there are good people. And I've learned that as I've worked with Republicans and Democrats in the Problem Solvers Caucus, that there are people who are sincerely and genuinely interested in making our country a better place. We serve because we love this country. And if we're going to get anything done, if we're going to enact the things that I care about, economic support, expanding access to affordable quality healthcare, it's going to have to be in a bipartisan way. We've got to work together. And I think that's what people hired us to do, is we work for the American people. My district does not belong to the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. It belongs to the people of Utah. And I know who my boss is, and I will work with them, for them, and we'll work across the aisle with Republicans and Democrats to get my job done.
That was 4th Congressional District incumbent, Democrat Representative Ben McAdams. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. On this program, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. Today, we are airing a conversation with the candidates for Utah's 4th Congressional District, Democratic Representative Ben McAdams and Republican challenger Burgess Owens. Here again is moderator, director Jason Perry.
Okay, it's now my pleasure to introduce Burgess Owens, Republican candidate for Utah's 4th Congressional District. After a coin toss, we determined that you would go second. It's great to have you with us today.
Jason, looking forward to this, for sure.
I'm so glad to have this conversation. As we've discussed previously, we try to go through the policies that are top of mind for Utahns, but particularly in this district, that you are looking to lead. And I want to get into some of those policy issues, Burgess, but can we take just a moment to get to know you even a little better? We know some of your history. We had a chance to follow along through this campaign. But for Utahns who don't know you as well yet, a little bit about your background.
Okay, well, for those who haven't known about me, I grew up in the Deep South, ended up going to the University of Miami. I was the third Black American to go to play football there. At that time, I was a very introverted, very shy guy. I would never do what I'm doing now. I decided I was going into marine biology, so I graduated biology and chemistry degree. Thank goodness I got some more confidence as time went on, went into sales. And so I now have had the confidence to at least have this kind of conversations with you. So it's been a great time. I'll say this too. I sent my 6 children to come to school out this way back starting in 1998. And it was because of the values that we have in the Valley. My promise was for them, look at any college across the country, as long as you start your first year in Utah. They all started out this way, and 12 years later, I realized they weren't coming home. They were getting married and having babies, so we joined them, and it's the greatest move I've ever made. I hope to have a chance to talk a little bit about the values I grew up in Tallahassee, but those values that have created me, my values, my direction, my priorities are the same values I'm fighting for here, and I'm just thankful to be in a district that truly does resonate with my thoughts that I've had, and I look forward to making sure those values are taken back to D.C. and not vice versa. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that this is not a position you thought you might be in one day, and it doesn't come without a whole lot of self-reflection and conversations with people you trust. So let me talk about that for just a moment. Why did you decide to jump into politics now, and particularly in this district?
First of all, I've been asked if I wanted to ever be a politician, and I've said over and over again up until last year, never ever would I do this. But my mission when I left NFL, I left at the very top of my career as an All-Pro going into a free agency season. But I wanted to start a business that I thought would have a chance to bring back the community that I grew up in, that I was seeing was going in the wrong direction. I grew up in a really remarkable, successful, Christian-based, entrepreneurial, focused on family kind of environment, even though it was segregated community. And I saw we were losing that. So 30 plus years ago, I decided to leave the NFL to do that. It took me a while to come to Utah. When I finally came here, I started a program called Second Chance for Youth, which is my dream for decades. I've talked to my dad about it, my kids have heard me discuss that. And I thought that was going to be my final kind of mission, things I was going to do. And then I realized about a year or so ago that the kids I work with, those are young boys and girls coming out of the juvenile system, and our goal was to help make sure they didn't go back in. They don't have a chance as long as the Democrats continue to hold on to the House and continue to have the policies that they've been that's been part of the process. And I'll say this, Jason, this country is the direction of those at risk are really predicated on the policies that they have to deal with. When you have policies in which children do not have a choice of education, when they don't have as they grow up a choice of jobs, or they have an education in which they truly are not taught to love our country, those things end up catching up with us. And I realized last year that if we don't get the House back, our kids don't have a chance. And so my goal right now is to be part of many patriots across this country that finally get the House back, to put the values that our country's been built upon, education, faith, free market, and the family unit, put those at the forefront from patriots, not those who want to go there to be career politicians or lobbyists, but have a priority to do that. If we do that this time around, I believe we'll get our country back on track. And I'm excited about being part of that conversation.
Mm-hmm. As a member of Congress, the number of issues coming before you is just so amazingly varied and different, and the impacts can be just quite enormous. So I'm wondering if you take just a second to talk about your approach. If you are elected here, when these bills come to you, what is your approach to analyzing them and deciding how you are going to best represent CD4?
Very, very good. Thank you so much for that. My approach will be based on what I know works. And there are values that we have in this country that our founders began this country with, that I watched my community grow with. And it's something that no matter how you come here, how long you've been here, what language you speak, if you tie yourself into these tenets, you will succeed. You'll be within a generation away or less of being part of the middle class. And if you fall out of the middle class like I did, you can come back within years. It's very simple. Let's focus on education. Ignorant and free can never be. If we don't teach ourselves our history, what's made our country great, what has been the foundation that everybody can come here and succeed with, then we lose that. So we have to make sure we hold on to that education. Faith. We're Judeo-Christian values, a country built on Judeo-Christian values. We need to fight for the fact that that's who we are. And because of that, every generation gets better at seeing each other from inside out, not outside in. We're fighting a secular ideology that wants to take away our ability to worship and to, however that faith might look, it allows us again to want to be better people because we know there's a God in heaven that will bless us if we do so. The free market. What I love about Utah, I absolutely love it. 277,000 business owners, 93% are small business owners. It's the small business owners that create our middle class, that give us the culture we have here of vision, of faith, of patience. All the things that draw us to people to this valley is because we have this culture built on those who say, come to my business with a bad day. And when you leave here, you go leave with a good day. So you can come back again tomorrow to do the same thing. That's who we are. And last but not least is the family unit. What strengthened my community back when I was growing up is we led the country in the commitment of men to marriage and our commitment to the family unit. We've lost that. So I'm here to serve kind of as a warning buoy. I want Americans to realize just because we have the idea of self-sufficiency, we understand the American dream, it's not promised to keep it. There is an ideology that wants to take that away from us. I saw it happen to my community. I am determined not to let that happen to Utah and not to let it happen to our nation. We need to fight against an enemy from within. It's an ideology. It's one that wants to take away our life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And I want to make sure that we hold on to that in a big way. So all my policies will be based on that. I want to say this real quickly as we talk about healthcare, because that's important. What we do is we come up with great ideas. What I love about Utah is we have a balanced budget. We have things where people have to come up with solutions today. we in the state here that actually has, House Bill 207, in which we have there's a copay for those who have problems with diabetes, that with a copay of $30, you can get, even if you don't have insurance, you can get that kind of medication. That was this year that our House representatives, our legislators got that together. So we need to be proud of our representatives that come up with solutions like that. And therefore, we don't have to be concerned about things like the pre-existing conditions that so far has been talked about. I am a cancer survivor. I have a daughter who has sickle cell trait. I have a granddaughter who has cerebral palsy. Guess what? We now have an executive order by our President of the United States to make sure that that will be in place. That's a policy for our nation. We have both the House and the Senate that's passed legislation that's going to protect that. So I would say this, we need to be looking forward in a positive way, in the way we all do it with optimism. Let's not let fear drive us and get us in going in the direction that this is not the American way. So I hope I answered that. A long answer to a short question, but I hope I came to that conclusion, Jason.
Yeah, it's good, because I'd like to dive into a couple of those policy issues that you identified there as well. As I mentioned in the first segment, we've done some polling in your district. We're talking about the issues that are most important, particularly as people are thinking about the President of the United States, but there are issues that resonate throughout your district in the 4th Congressional District, and they are these, because they're tied to the things that you were just mentioning. 40% of your constituents would say that the economy is the most important aspect. Related to that, 19% COVID-19 and the response from the country to that, and 12% connected to healthcare as being the top priority. So these three things are completely connected. And you mentioned those just a moment ago. So I'd like to dive in to those for just a moment. And first, starting with the economic crisis. There have been a couple of approaches in Washington, D.C. to this. I'm kind of curious what your thought is about how the best way is to stimulate the economy. Some feel like the best thing to do is to fill a hole. You look at the devastation that happened and we fill it. Some also have sort of an idea that what we'd like to do is just add the stimulus. We'd like to jumpstart. Do either one of those particularly appeal to you? Maybe a combination, just whatever you think.
Okay, first of all, we do need to jumpstart. We didn't come through a depression or a recession. We came through a suppression in which we were told to shut things down. We had big dreams of coming into a great year. So we have to make sure that those who are in need targeted in a way that those, first of all, running businesses, because the business owners is going to be really the catapult of making sure this all happens. And I can't speak enough high about that because, again, this economy, that Utah's economy has come back very strong because we have businesses that actually sit down and figure out how can we make sure that people feel safe as they come into my environment and that they continue to come back again. So we need to make sure that a lot of decisions the business owners are putting to the table. We need to make sure that it's targeted so that those who are the PPP was a great idea. Unfortunately, and this is what we're dealing with in D.C., Nancy Pelosi held up the PPP the first time for 2 weeks because she wanted other things to be put into the plate that had nothing to do with COVID. She demanded that we have a $600 added addition to the unemployment, which at the end of the day, if people are paid more not to work, we don't work. Work is what makes us tick, that the feeling of worth to something that somebody else. And we need business owners to have the ability to go out in the marketplace and find people who want to come back to work with them. So we have to make sure that we don't allow things like those kind of issues that are being put into the last one with Pelosi that literally just slows our economy down and not allow us to grow as fast, not to let that happen. Meanwhile, we have some businesses that are doing very, very well. So they don't need the PPP. But we do need to have that little on-ramp and then get out of the way and allow business to go to work. I think the biggest thing about warp speed is a prototype of what we can do when we take away the regulation, we take away the bureaucracy. We literally had business running the show with government backing them up and supporting them instead of vice versa. We had within 9 or 10 months, the potential of a vaccine that takes years or decades to come through. If we were able to do the same thing with our economy, take away some of these regulations that have been holding us behind, construction is a great idea. How about what President Trump did is took away 22 regulations for everyone they added on to. Imagine if they were to do that to construction here, the housing problems we're having would not be as strong as this because we'll have a lot faster production and a lot cheaper production. So we had to come together with some better ideas when it comes to this. And meanwhile, let's make sure that those who need the injection to get started now, get going, get out of the way for government, and let's not put things in place that's going to slow us down versus helping us to move further faster.
So it sounds like if you're elected, you would support an additional stimulus package of some sort. And I think you just gave us a flavor of it, of what you would want, but maybe just identify one or two things that would absolutely get your support in that stimulus package.
Well, for sure, the PPP. And again, it really does come down to targeting. We now know from what we just had the chance to go through, what industries have been taken off and doing pretty well. For instance, in Utah, it's hard to believe, and I'm in Nashville, Tennessee right now. You know, the industries that kicked off very well, that never slowed down, was construction. Amazing, they continue to grow at a pace that nothing else came close to. So we need to make sure that those industries, they don't need the support that the hospitality industry might need, for instance. So we have to target that. And I think the most important thing is let's bring the business owner to the table. We're finding out now, after just a couple of days ago, and this is because of 3,500 infectious doctors came together and put an open letter that the lockdown was a disaster. The last thing we need to do because of the disaster, the unintended consequences of health and mental health and physical health, that we should not be doing. That should be the last thing we do. Well, how about if we now allow the business owners to open up their business, make sure that their customers feel safe, and come to their business and start this whole thing, this process up again. Protect those that are at risk. We understand who that is now. And let's make sure the schools, the churches, the businesses open up so we get back to normal and do what we do best. You know, I played with the Raiders back in the days when Al Davis had a real short slogan that I can apply today. That is just win, baby. Allow us to get back to work and we just win, baby. And that's what we do best. So allow us to get that done, get out of the way, and we can get a lot more accomplished.
Before we leave the economic part there, there have been some discussions in Washington, D.C. about mortgage protection, things like this, eviction protections. Thoughts about those things as they relate to the economy? Because that's certainly an issue in the 4th Congressional District.
It is. And what we have to do again, when I said before, we're looking at this quite differently where it might have been talking another, 2 or 3 years ago, even a few months ago. This is something so different and attacked us in such a different way. That people are literally at risk that never thought they would be a year or so ago, making great plans of how they can increase their income and maybe go out and build and have a home. And now they're trying to figure out how they can hold on to their apartment. So we have to, again, target this where we can have a way to give that bridge to those during this period of time until our economy can really come back a little bit stronger. It has to be done in a way, again, that does not give incentives, though. My biggest concern about this process is not giving incentive to people not to work, not to pay the bills, not to be a responsible people. So that there's a balance there. And I think that's the real fight between the Democrats and the Republican Party. I will say this, there are good people in both parties. They're good people, independent. Let's understand, though, that there's a party, the Democratic Party, has an ideology that is not congruent with District 4. We don't believe in no limit abortion. We don't believe that God should be kicked out of everything that we do. We believe in choice for our kids. The Democratic Party, it goes against every single one of those things I just mentioned. We believe in capitalism. We believe that people should have a business, hold on to their income, and reinvest or pass that down to their kids. There's another party that does not believe that. So just know that as we vote for this district, and I'll say this real quick, Jason, this district between 1 and 3 are must-have of both sides. The Democrats must have it. I'm going to say this because of the leadership I see in the Democratic Party. They must have it for their power and their chaos that is going on right now. The other side, my party, needs to have it to most sure we hold on to our culture and our country. I think it's so cool after 245-year history of our country that District 4 is literally the linchpin. Our values can dictate which way our country goes. And our values is why people come here in droves. Let's make sure we take our values to D.C. and not let D.C. values come here. And our country will be blessed by it. I'll be the first to say we did it. It was Utah who got us on track. So give us the credit. But let's do that. Let's stand up for our values and make sure that that we're not taking it in a way we just don't want to see our country taken.
You addressed a couple of points in the healthcare aspects, but also in the COVID response as well. You mentioned this Operation Warp Speed for the vaccine. Do you see this as something where Congress can actually push it forward, or is it just a matter of staying out of the way? What are you seeing that you can do to get that thing going?
What I love about Warp Speed, my goodness, it's a prototype. You know, we've had these issues for literally decades. We've been talking about the debt. We've been talking about healthcare, Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare. this has been on the plate forever. And guess what? We're now, 10, 15 years away from Social Security going insolvent. You know, a few years ago, maybe 5 years away from Medicare aid going insolvent. What we need is a warp speed in every single one of these areas. And it comes down to, let's getting the career politicians out of the way and bring some new thought into it. How about, and when it comes down to, and by the way, yeah, warp speed brings in a way of not only thinking about a problem in a new way, but bringing new thoughts into the process and putting those who can truly think as entrepreneurs in front. How about with healthcare? Not only making sure we keep the pre-existing conditions, which we've already agreed on, keep those who want to allow their children to be on their part of their plan. That's fine, that's good. But how about this? How about transparency? Who goes into a McDonald's to buy a Big Mac to get charged 2 months later and have no idea what the price is? We don't do that anything else. Let's have transparency. And how about this little idea? How about portability? The concept of that we have our own insurance, program and policy is ours. Whether we take it with us for whatever job we go to, we would decide when we take it to a business for our own. We have those choices of living our life in a way we want to, not based on who gives us the best insurance, but what our dreams dictate to us. These are different ways we can think about all these issues, and it comes down to what we did with warp speed. We broke the mold in terms of coming up with a vaccine, and here we are. We're about to have it approved. People have a choice of taking it, and all of a sudden we have a whole different conversation. It's a new way of thinking, and it's the conservative values that get it there. It's not the parties leading us towards socialism, toward government control. That party doesn't do what we're talking about doing now. So let's make sure we keep that light eternal and hand this over to folks who can really come up with solutions because they think outside the box.
Mm-hmm. Several of these items that you just mentioned are connected to the Affordable Care Act. And it's hard to believe it's 10 years old and it's still just as top of mind as it has been for such a really long time. These things you just mentioned, like portability, transparency, is your approach right now, if you're in this position, is to try to just adapt the Affordable Care Act, or because there's some efforts out there to maybe get rid of it altogether?
Well, you know, no. I think sometimes we have amnesia about Obamacare. Obamacare was a disaster. Premiums went up over $7,000 per family. We had deductibles that nobody could ever get to. We lost our insurance and we lost our policy, we lost our doctors. And we were forced to pay whether we wanted to or not, whether we could afford to or not. So what we can come out of with Obamacare is there's some good things that came out of it. Let's build around it. Pre-existing conditions is a good thing. It's no question. If a parent wants to keep their children on their plan, that's good. And that should be their choice also. But we bring into that other things. How about the free market now? Instead of the government controlling our health, give us a choice. Guess what happens with choice across our country? As we all know, when there's transparency and there's choice, cost goes down and value of the product goes up. That's what makes our country such a great country. We should do the same thing we do when we go to Costco or Jiffy Lube, wherever it might be. We go there because of either value, cost, or the convenience, whatever it is. Let that happen to our for the healthcare industry. Let's think about it differently. Let's think about Social Security, by the way, should be there very simply this. Keep your word. Those who have depended on that, those that are older like myself, I'm a senior citizen, we now are most vulnerable because we no longer have production years. Keep the promise that you gave us, and let's figure out a way to make sure my kids and grandkids, their promises are kept also. We should come up with a program using warp speed mentality that when they get to my age, their deal is so much better than mine, they can't even come close to it. We can do that by thinking outside the box, having the courage to break the mold of what's gone in the past. And again, with the career politicians, that's a very, very tough thing to do. For those who've never taken a risk, that's a very, very tough thing to do. Those in the state of Utah understand that 93% of small business owners, you wake up every single day, you cannot afford to kick the can down the road. You figure out the day, you come up with new ideas, and we've seen how that works out just with COVID, how creative we can be when we deal with issues. So we need to do that with healthcare.
Mm-hmm. Some of the impact that you'll have, at least right out of the gate, will connect to the committee assignments that you would get. Have you given some thought to what particular committees you are interested in on behalf of CD4?
Yes. Education. One of the things that I'm real focused on, and I can't say this enough, my dad was a college educator, so I grew up in that environment. Ignorant and free can never be. What we're dealing with right now, and I think we all see across the country, this craziness. We have college-educated kids that are out there burning down buildings. We have people that are college-educated kids, people going to college, making $50 million a year on the football field, cannot stand for our flag. It's because in our school system for decades, we've been attacked by the far left. We've been our kids, 70% of millennials today believe socialism is really cool. They have no idea. The 100 million people killed last century, men, women, and children because of the devious, godless ideology of Marxism and socialism. So we need to educate, we need to get back. And my goal very simply is this, our product are our kids. We send our kids to these schools and they come out with an enormous amount of debt, with degrees that mean nothing and hating our country. We need to take our money and put it to another place. This should be meritocracy, be transparency. If they're not graduating our kids, if they're coming there and leaving school without all this debt and no real value, we need to pull our money back and put it someplace else. If we can't have a curriculum that our kids, we have to import people from India and China, we need to pull our money back. We have the greatest kids in the history of mankind in this country. All we need to do is train and teach them. Teach them about respect of God, country, family, women, and authority. Teach them that they truly can bring a lot of value to this great country and teach them about our history. Jason, I'll say this. The greatest danger to our nation is we don't learn our history. To learn what we the people have done together across the board. My community would not be, my dad would not have gotten to his PhD at Ohio State if not being a white person there. I have no idea who he was, but he accepted him and allowed him to go to college in 1950. We have had this interaction with people across the board, all races, all colors, and we need to focus on what we've done together versus this notion that because of our color, we should either be angry or apologize. That is the worst place of racism, and that's not our country. We're better every single generation. So education will be top. Next one will be business and labor. I think at the end of the day, our culture is defined by those who get out there, take a risk, fall flat on their face, get back up. They get back up humble, more humble, but they're dedicated to their dreams. And because they are, they can pass that legacy down to their kids. So I want to make sure regulations are being eliminated, that we can compete against the big stores. There should not be a monopoly in our country when small businesses can actually get out there and compete and give a better service. We need to make sure that they're kept safe and that those who are making their money through this risk process can keep it. We're not entitled for somebody else's risk, somebody else's effort and sweat, blood, sweat, and tears. So we need to make sure that we're now teaching our kids that, but also plan that to our policies.
Mm-hmm. One more thing about your district. You have a wide range of interests, from a very, very urban to fairly rural in San Pete County, some beautiful places in the central part of the state. What is your thought about how you make sure you represent both those interests? Because they're not always completely aligned.
And that's what I love. I have loved this last year because I had a small niche, a slice of what Utah was about, and I just love the fact I've met people up and down the state. What I would suggest for down south is that there's been a land grab for decades. There's over 3 million acres that now has been set aside as an executive order by two presidents, in which it's monuments. There's nothing we here have decided to do. They've set it aside because it's the way that the government does, Washington, D.C. They decide for us what lands need to be set aside and cannot be touched. We lose revenue, we lose business opportunities. That needs to change down south. We can't even control our forest fires because the government has made these monuments and they decide back in D.C. What should be done there. So that's the first thing. Education is a new civil rights. I can't emphasize that enough. We have 75% of Black boys in the state of California, 2017, cannot pass standard reading and writing tests. We have 13 schools in Baltimore has zero proficiency in math. These are the kids that our kids would have to try to negate some kind of way because their idea of America would be totally different than ours. So education should be the very top, and that means this. Broadband access should be accessible and affordable. It's accessible up north, but it's not affordable to everybody. So there are kids right now that have not gotten any education because they can't afford, their parents can't afford broadband. Down south, it's not accessible. So you have people showing up around school systems where there's a bus with a hotspot on it. And that's how they do it. This is something that is a crisis for our entire country. Federal, state, and local should be dealing with this because if we're ignorant and free can never be. And the greatest thing we owe to our kids is a quality education where they can think, they're not trolled by emotions, and they cannot be controlled by those who do not understand our country. So those would be the things that I think I would highlight. Of course, I talk about the business owner. I can't talk about them enough, but making sure that they can be a part of this entire process. One other thing, our decisions should be brought back locally, whether it be education. It doesn't matter. We don't need have DC making decisions for us. Bureau of Land Management did very simply, they took that from DC and put it into Grand Junction, Colorado. It's closer to we the people. They now understand what it truly is to have that process going on, and they're bringing revenue to that area. Let's look at all of our departments that way. Where can we set them so they can truly relate to the rest of us, and they're not making decisions for us that has nothing to do with our desires, our goals, and families' decisions about their kids. That's going to be very, 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 very important in this process.
Okay. Just one last question, if you don't mind. As I mentioned in the first segment, when we surveyed your district, party was not the number one issue for them. They were mostly interested in the kind of person they're going to get also in this district. So your thought, particularly on the backs of this this statement by Mitt Romney just yesterday, that it's time to get some civility back in politics. Your thoughts about what you will do to help make that happen in the last minute.
Civility happens because we the people do best. We communicate. That's what we do best. So short term, we need to put people in office that truly reflect our values. Education, faith, free market, and of course the family unit. That's the first part. So we get more of that. Now, the more of those that we get in office, that's across the board, the more the rest of the country will then be drawn to that. The Democratic Party will have to bring people in that feel the same way we do in order to have the conversation and to move forward with their goals. At the long term, is the more we teach about our history, the more we understand what we the people have done together, the more we're able to, even though we disagree, we can agree to disagree because we have the same end game. My siblings are all Democrats. I'm a Republican. We love each other. We have great debates, but our end game is the same. That's because we have the same basic information about what our country is based on. So there's a long term, which makes sure our kids understand and can think and be proud of who they are so we can have conversations no matter where we stand. In the short term, let's make sure that the Republican Party gets back to House, my friends. We need to put patriots in there that can work with the president and the Senate to make sure those values I just talked about are adhered to, and we not only can take our values back to D.C., but bring them back here.
That was 4th Congressional Republican challenger Burgess Owens. If you'd like to hear the full conversation, you can find it on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your producer and host of this program. As always, thanks for listening.